Yo, a veces rapeo lo que he vivido y prefiero simplemente pasar desapercibido, rimar de lo que nunca han hablado pero con cariño, que vengan a decir que solo soy un niño. Rapear desde hace años me parece extraño, siendo simplemente la oveja negra del rebaño, que simplemente yo soy un puto fenómeno. Monótono cuando estoy frente al micrófono, solo lo puedo soltar pero no tengo respaldo, porque yo para rapear en el fútbol el gordo Ronaldo. Tengo versos, tengo no pero perversos, y a veces yo controlo el universo al unir versos. Vengo rapeando desde hace rato y yo con el hip hop no he firmado un contrato, pero yo creo que en el día lo firmé fue con mis rimas, y el contrato creo que va a durar toda la vida. Tengo un ingenio grande pero se expande, por eso creo que estoy dando pasos tan gigantes. Soy ese mismo elefante que está dando pasos cortos pero aplastantes. MC Flaco es de Medellín, gente.
Yeah, yeah, Manzanero, Manzanero presente. Rebel Diaz, baby. No espera que arranque la pista. You already know what we do. Veterano, baby. Yes, New York City. Yo, we're gonna do it like this. You ready? Check this out. 1, 2. Yeah. Okay, I'm on it like this one. Tengo tiempo esperando for the time to strike, yo. Y los bloqueados son te tocan when I'm ripping mics. So coge gana when you hear some that I'm on your block. Y sal pa' fuera como Maggi that you with a knife, yo. Mucho pregunta, yo, fool, yo, how you get this right? Yo le contesto, son, old school, can always fight. I pull the knife out, yo, I just have the light. You niggas kill the beat, but that's alright, cause I just rockin' rights, huh? Sometimes I take a flight, sometimes I take a fight, and hit a nigga, yo, crack him with the mic. Yo, sometimes it's freestyle with Rebel Diaz, said it's all good. So I come through and I reckon it's Brooklyn hood, yeah. Yo, I got shit coming off this Friday, with my people from La Conecta, we're gonna hit you, cause yo, you bet correcta. The effect is like the trifecta, 3 times we win it. You wanna get in it, Manzanero is just a fucking exhibit. Yo, I kill it, yo, I'm gonna pass it on, cause I need to beat this off, but yo, I'ma pass it to my man Cardona Calle. Hit him 1 time with no debate. Come on.
Jate mate, el arrebate. Así fue desde los llores, señores, los mayores y los jóvenes. Yo, you already know what it is, man. La Conecta, Calle Cardona. Shout out to Dustin Hoffman calling in. Shout out to Uncle Val, Rebel Diaz Radio. Thank you for having us. La Conecta, this Friday. This Friday. 8937 164th Street, Nut Raises, Nut So Throughway, it's too many. La Conecta on Instagram, La Conecta Show on Instagram. Shoot flyer, everybody's invited. She's coming down. 10th year, 10th anniversary. Thank you, my brothers, for having us. Appreciate y'all.
Bless, bless, bless.
Rebel Diaz Radio. Tune in next week. Let's go.
Sir.
Peace.
Peace.
This is the ghost of Ronald Reagan with a serious message. If you think I was evil, you ain't seen nothing yet. Yes, I admit I did a lot of bad things when I was in charge and I paid a heavy price. I mean, it's hot down here. During my reign, WBAI was in my face constantly. But that was then and this is now. Now, you're dealing with a much more dangerous threat. Donald Trump is totally out of control. He's vindictive, unstable, and wears jackboots. Bad combo. I firmly believe the only outlet with the courage, integrity, and talent to take this man on is WBAI. The rest of the media is bought and paid for. So I urge you to keep listening and supporting WBAI, because it's going to be hell on earth.
This is an urgent call to action for all listeners to WBAI. The station is in the midst of grappling with a lawsuit with the Empire State Building's owners, and a negative judgment could threaten our ability to keep broadcasting. New Yorkers know that WBAI is unique. If we lose it, we will not get it back. We are calling for the withdrawal of the lawsuit and a release from the rest of the unconscionable lease. We need to show a united front. Please come to a press conference to be held on the City Hall steps this Thursday, July 13th. We will gather at the Center Street entrance gate to City Hall at 12:30 p.m., but arrive early because you need to get through security checks and metal detectors. Elected city officials, other prominent leaders, and some of your favorite WBAI producers will be speaking. That's this Thursday, July 13th, 12:30 p.m. at the Center Street entrance gate to City Hall. Your participation is vital. For more information, call 347-647-WBAI. Once again, that's 347-647-WBAI. Thank you.
Welcome to Health Action. I'm Mark Hannay, Director of Metro New York Healthcare for All and a member of the Health Action Program that brings you this program every week. In our first interview segment of this week's program, we're going to be taking a look at immigrant healthcare issues in Washington, D.C. and here in New York, doing a bit of catch-up on what's been happening. So stay tuned for that. And Bob Letter will be here during the second half of the program, continuing his series of excerpts from the recent ACT UP 30th Anniversary Conference called Hidden Voices. But first, we'll start with the Health Action News for this week, taken from stories posted to KaiserHealthNews.org. The congressional newspaper The Hill reports that a nonpartisan campaign watchdog group is accusing President Trump's Health and Human Services Secretary, Dr. Tom Price, of misusing congressional campaign cash to push for his cabinet nomination last winter. The Campaign Legal Center filed a complaint last week with the Federal Election Commission that pointed to a $40,000 payment made in January by the former Georgia congressman's campaign team to America Rising, a Republican consulting firm. The complaint points to videos urging senators to vote to confirm Price that were released around the same date as the payment. Dr. Price's actions may have violated a campaign finance law that bans members of Congress from using campaign funds for personal benefit. Such a ruling would need to investigate whether Dr. Price's payment to America Rising was tied to materials asking senators to vote for his confirmation and whether any exclusions apply. Dr. Price was confirmed as the Health and Human Services Secretary back in February. NPR reports that Americans really, really don't like the Senate bill to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. Only 17% of U.S. adults approve of the health care bill, according to a recent NPR Marist PBS NewsHour poll. In fact, a majority of Americans now approve of the Affordable Care Act. Just 9 months ago, that wasn't true. So what do they want, however? Maybe they want a single-payer health system. A slight majority of Americans now say they'd like that kind of system, according to a Kaiser Family Foundation. However, many don't like it as much once they hear about its trade-offs. So maybe they simply want the ACA to go further. That's what a plurality of respondents told NPR. Or to be more specific, they favor most of the current law's provisions, just not the individual mandate, which is needed to make the law actually work. Or maybe they want to keep the Affordable Care Act but scrap Obamacare, or vice versa. Some of this uncertainty is to be expected. As President Trump has pointed out, health care is, quote, complicated. However, if lawmakers are looking to Americans to know what their next move should be, they could be waiting a while. Messy, contradictory, easily swayable opinions on health care are a common theme in American politics. Americans' views on healthcare are hard to understand for a number of reasons. One is a lack of knowledge. Some of that knowledge is basic, not knowing, for example, that there's no difference between the Affordable Care Act and Obamacare. But many Americans may also not understand how the individual mandate makes the other parts of the law work. Another reason is fear. Americans fear big changes on something that is acutely sensitive and a very personal subject. However, that fear is nuanced. People like the broad idea of change, but it's the particulars that oftentimes scare them off. And then finally, there's blatant politics. On all of these questions, there are, of course, sharp political divides driving people's opinions. The Affordable Care Act became widely known as Obamacare, meaning that many Americans, that is, those who know the two are synonymous, may have linked their approval to the act or disapproval to former President Obama per se and their opinions on him. And finally, Kaiser Health News reports that a little discussed provision in the Senate's health care bill is designed to boost the number of hospital beds for psychiatric care, providing a long-sought victory for mental health advocates. The provision would amend an obscure Medicaid funding rule that has sharply limited the number of beds for those with schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, or other serious mental health illnesses. Yet leading mental health groups say they see no reason to celebrate. That's because the Senate bill would also wring out $772 billion from Medicaid overall. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office has said that the Senate bill drafted by Republicans as a replacement for the Affordable Care Act would reduce Medicaid spending by 26% over the next decade and by 35% in the following decade. The loss of those funds would devastate healthcare services for people with mental illness, who are some of the most vulnerable and disadvantaged people in the country, according to the Bazelon Center for Mental Health Law and Advocacy Group. Medicaid is a safety net for people with serious mental illness, said a spokesperson for the National Alliance for Mental Illness, and that without that mental health care and support services, people with psychiatric disorders can quickly deteriorate, ending up in overcrowded emergency rooms, jails and prison cells, or dangerous city streets. Republicans who crafted the Senate draft bill claim the Medicaid spending will still increase under their plan, but just at a lower rate than currently projected. The Senate bill would make Medicaid spending more sustainable, according to a spokesman for the Senate Finance Committee. The Medicaid program has traditionally refused to pay for inpatient stays in large freestanding psychiatric hospitals, making exceptions for patients under age 21 and facilities with 16 or fewer beds. The rule, which has changed little since Medicaid was created 5 decades ago, was aimed to prevent the federal government from paying for long-term care in psychiatric institutions. The new Senate bill would allow states to receive federal matching Medicaid funds for up to 30 days of consecutive days of inpatient psychiatric care and up to 90 days in a given year. The Medicaid change was included in the Republican bill because several senators were concerned that patients didn't have enough access to hospital care for mental illness and addiction services. Those senators involved include Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah and Senator Rob Portman of Ohio. And that's the Health Action News for this week. We'll be back with our first segment taking a look at current immigration health care issues in Washington, D.C. and here in New York. Stay tuned. First interview segment in this week's program, we're going to be catching up on immigrant healthcare issues nationally and here in New York. Bringing us up to date is Claudia Calhoun, Health Policy Director with the New York Immigration Coalition. Welcome back to Health Action, Claudia.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
So the big news in healthcare, of course, everyone's talking about what's going on in Washington. So let's start there, but let's provide a little context first. The fight in Washington is all about the continuance or future of the Affordable Care Act. What was the situation for immigrants before the act came into being, and what did the act do for immigrants and their families?
Yeah, I mean, the Affordable Care Act has been good for all sorts of different groups of healthcare consumers in this country, but immigrants really, really, immigrants who are lawfully present and were able to benefit really, really did see improvements in coverage and access under the law. The uninsured rate for working age Latino adults, for example, fell in 2016 from 43% to 25%. So it made a really, really big difference in communities across the country in terms of offering access to people who were defined as lawfully present by the bill or by the law.
And so what did the law actually change?
Well, the marketplaces and the Medicaid expansion gave people the opportunity to enroll in programs where they hadn't been before, and that's something that's true of a lot of different people, but we know that immigrants from in a lot of different communities were able to take advantage of it. And, of course, in places like New York State, where you have a Spanish-language marketplace website and you had really good outreach to a lot of different communities, many people sort of learned about it and learned that they could take advantage of these programs and were able to enroll and participate and benefit. And so all the consumer protections that are in the Affordable Care Act that are good for everyone are especially good for immigrants because they help with affordability and accountability and making sure that insurance companies can't dump people off coverage or discriminate against them on the basis of a pre-existing condition. So immigrants really benefited from all of that stuff.
And were there any changes around the Medicaid program that opened it up to more immigrants under the new law?
Well, the Medicaid expansion meant that there were more people who were eligible for coverage. And New York State embraced the Affordable Care Act in a bunch of different ways, and it expanded its Medicaid. And specifically in New York State, that meant that New York State commits Medicaid based on its constitution and legal history, like history of court decisions, it covers people who are what's called permanently residing under color of law here in New York State with state financed Medicaid. And so many people were able to take advantage of Medicaid coverage, which allows them to stay healthy, get their health needs taken care of, take care of their families, go to work, and generally have more stability and better access to care because of that.
And then here in New York, we also have the new Essential Plan.
Mm-hmm.
What did that do for immigrants?
Right. Well, I mean, one of the things that did was because some of those individuals were able to take advantage or are entitled to Medicaid, the Essential Plan actually covers some of the people that before were covered with state financed Medicaid. And so there actually was a really, there were more federal dollars. It gets a little complicated when you think about how all of it's paid for, but really what it meant was that by creating the Essential Plan and covering people, using it to cover people who previously they covered with state financed dollars, they were able to bring additional revenues, federal revenues, into the economy many millions of dollars.
Okay, so Congress is now busily at work trying to repeal as much of the Affordable Care Act and make some dramatic changes to Medicaid as they possibly can, although they seem to be currently stalled in the Senate. The House first took up the matter, and they passed their bill called the American Health Care Act in early May. What did that do for access to health care and health coverage for immigrants, if anything?
So, I mean, there are many, many things that were bad for all kinds of groups of healthcare consumers in the House bill, but one of the things that it would have done is it rolled back the definition of who was eligible. So it means it wouldn't cover people who were lawfully present. It would only cover people who meet something called qualified alien status, which is actually takes us back to the time of welfare reform and the law that was passed under Clinton. And so it's a much narrower, much more restrictive definition. And so it meant that people who were survivors, who were serious crimes, who were cooperating with law enforcement, would no longer be able to take advantage of coverage. People who have fled torture or persecution and are seeking asylum but haven't been approved yet also would not be able to take advantage of coverage. People who had something that's called temporary protected status, where in their home country there's been a disaster and the government extends the opportunity to stay for a temporary period, they also would not be considered eligible anymore. So there's big groups of immigrants that kind of would have gotten would be cut off, even though they are here in this country, quote unquote, lawfully.
Now, the Senate leadership has put its bill on the table called the Better Care Reconciliation Act. Mm-hmm. Are there any differences between it and the House bill when it comes to coverage and access to care for immigrants?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's even worse because in addition to changing that eligibility, it also makes it harder for people to enroll or use the marketplace at all. It keeps them from being able to get tax subsidies, and it actually would, from a logistical perspective, people would have trouble even enrolling in insurance at full cost on the marketplace because of how the law is written.
Anything else? I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I mean, on top of that, all of the other terrible things that the law does would be especially bad for immigrants. So, you know, you know this better than anyone. Mark, it destroys the Medicaid program as we know it by changing the structure of making it paid by something that's per capita or through block grants instead of being an entitlement, and it reduces the tax credits that would be available to people. And it undermines all the consumer protections, specifically the pre-existing protections that the Affordable Care Act offered. So all of those things which are bad for everybody are going to be especially difficult for immigrants.
And let me just maybe take a sidetrack here. Immigrants who come to this country, my sense is, are often really baffled by the way the American healthcare system works. Can you describe a little bit of those challenges for immigrants?
Sure. I mean, that is something that's probably, was something
it
that we...
It baffles us who are native-born, I dare say.
Well, yeah, there's that. I mean, that is something we were certainly working on, and even with the Affordable Care Act, you know, healthcare is extremely fragmented and extremely confusing, and so people understanding things like what is a copay, what is a deductible, you know, what is a network, those things are tough for everybody and especially confusing for immigrants who come from... countries where they may come from somewhere like South Korea, which has an excellent and very straightforward healthcare system, or they may come from somewhere where there isn't as fully developed an infrastructure, but actually when they need to get into a health center, they can. And so, that was something before these threats to the Affordable Care Act that we were working on to make better and to continue to, you know, get as much information as possible about how to navigate this very complicated world and what lies at the intersection of sort of health law and immigration law, you know, like how to make sense of it. And, you know, with all of these potential changes, it really makes it, you know, people, you know, and coupled with the uptick in immigration enforcement, which is really, really scaring people. People are afraid to use the healthcare system at all, even people that are entitled to coverage and benefits.
Now, there's a bill that's been introduced in Congress called the Verify First Act. How would that impact immigrants' access to healthcare and coverage?
Yeah, that's really important. It is a bill that passed the House. It hasn't passed the Senate yet, but it would do something similar to what's actually in the Senate bill, which it would be to it would require an individual to verify their citizenship or immigration status before receiving any kind of tax credit. So it just means that if you have any kind of challenge with having your immigration status verified when you go to enroll in a marketplace plan, they're not going to proactively sort of extend you coverage until you get that straightened out. You're just simply not going to be able to have coverage until you've been able to do that, and that's a period. It could be a period of as many as a few months, and so it creates sort of, to your point, it creates a real additional disincentive with everything else going on that makes it so difficult to navigate sort of health insurance. It would just create a very, very profound barrier to participating, even for people who are entitled.
You mentioned the administration's move sort of tightening up, shall we say, immigration policy here. How is that affecting people trying to access health care and coverage?
Yeah, that's really important. We know that people are actually not keeping appointments. They're canceling appointments. They're not seeking health care. And so this actually pertains, I think, probably to lots of different immigrant groups, those who are entitled to coverage and those who aren't, but especially those who aren't. Like, here in New York City, we have a really robust system of public hospitals and federally qualified health centers, and they see people regardless of immigration status. But people are, because there is a really enhanced and targeted uptick in immigration enforcement activities, people are actually afraid that they might leave the house and have some contact with ICE and potentially be deported. And so people actually are not keeping appointments. They're not even, in some cases, reaching out to community-based organizations that provide services because they're afraid. So that has a really profound and sort of potential negative effect on population health really broadly, that you're seeing a whole group of people that are not seeking some of the primary and preventive care that's available to them, even if they're uninsured. And the other thing sort of to add to that is one of the documents that was leaked sort of from the administration is a draft executive order. And we've been doing some work with our partners at the National Immigration Law Center, and they're calling it the Scared, Sick, and Hungry executive order, because it would really change a lot of longstanding immigration policy practice around sort of whether people can take advantage of public benefits, whether there's any penalty or any consequence for taking advantage of benefits that they're entitled to. And so we actually are really afraid that people who are entitled to Medicaid or food stamps, if this executive order came out, it would justifiably make them feel nervous that they would not be able to someday get a green card if they try to adjust their status. Right now, food stamps and Medicaid are something that you can use safely without having any impact on your ability to adjust your status. And this executive order would actually change that. So I want to be really clear, that is not something that has come to pass yet. It has not been signed. But we do know that there are people in the administration that gave a great deal of thought to how that could work and how to keep immigrants from using those benefits that they are otherwise entitled to.
Now, the one bit, I guess, of good news coming out of Washington is that the Trump administration has made a decision around President Obama's executive order referencing deferred action on childhood arrivals for the so-called mm-hmm. Dreamer population. Explain a little bit about that and what, if any, impacts that might have for this group of immigrants in terms of accessing healthcare services and coverage.
So Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival is a program that was created with an executive order in 2012, and it's for people who meet a certain set of criteria, but people who came before a certain date to this country.
As children. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And so many of those young people, are growing up and have been able to take advantage of it, and they've been able to get a driver's license and a work permit. And so in New York State, they are actually part of the group that New York has made a real commitment to, because they are considered to be called permanently residing under color of law, or PRUCOL. And so they, based on that, they are eligible for New York State Medicaid. And so that's been the fact that the DACA program exists and New York's commitment to covering people who are what's called PRUCOL has been really important, because it's meant that those young people are able to take advantage of Medicaid as long as they don't make too much money. And so we didn't know, certainly, ending DACA was a campaign promise of the current administration, and we don't ultimately know the future of it, but for the time being, it sounds like they have decided to continue it, and we do know of people since the inauguration of people who have applied and been granted DACA. So, I think what the message for people who have DACA status or think they might be eligible or are thinking about renewing, it's probably at this point a smart idea to reach out to a legal service provider. And if you call our office, we can help you get you to a hotline, which has a whole list of them. And just to sort of consult on sort of what's available and what the next steps would be. But, it sounds like people should be able to continue taking advantage of the program. And if you have DACA and you are in New York State, then you should definitely talk to a health navigator about whether you're able to take advantage of Medicaid or not. It would depend on your income.
Great. Well, that's a good segue. Let's turn now to New York State. How would all of this stuff affect, and you've talked some about this, but maybe anything else that you'd like to add, how would any of the stuff happening in Washington affect immigrants here in New York?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it is certainly unknown. New York State does have a commitment to cover these certain populations, but we also know that New York State, depending on who you ask, sort of stands to lose as much as $10 billion in federal revenues to cover health care coverage. And so if that happens, we expect that there would it would have really dramatic repercussions on sort of who's eligible and what services are guaranteed, and would also have big implications sort of across the state budget. You know, and the other thing is that it would the way that it's proposed, and Mark, you could probably explain this better than I can, but the way that the bill proposes is to take resources away from New York and direct it to other states who have that have smaller, less costly Medicaid programs. And so it's a big sort of unknown in exactly how it'd play out and what the situation would be in Albany and sort of across the state if the bill is passed. And so we will certainly we know that it will require us to be sort of present in all those conversations and making sure that the Department of Health and lawmakers remember immigrants in the midst of what would be really, really profound change in how healthcare is paid for in the state.
Yeah, so I guess just to add on to that then, should all these Medicaid cuts come down to New York, then we sort of find ourselves in what might be termed a lifeboat situation and sort of who are you going to keep in the lifeboat and who are you going to throw overboard, if you will. And right. In that situation, immigrants could be one of the first ones to be considered for throwing out of the boat. I know this correctly.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing is that just in terms of thinking about the institutions that take care of people who don't have insurance.
That's true,
you know,
too.
You have, like, health in New York City health and hospitals. You have county hospitals across the state. And you have health centers, federally qualified health centers, and we expect that those institutions are already operating with tremendous fiscal challenges, and they are providing in many, many cases very, very high quality primary care and specialty care, but we expect that they could potentially be very adversely impacted by a big increase in people being uninsured, and so the quality. It will be really important to fight for them and make sure that they have the resources they need to sort of respond to any massive changes that might come.
Okay, so let's turn now to here to New York City in our final few minutes. There has been a pilot project that came out of the de Blasio administration a year or so back called Action Health, and it was oriented toward providing access to healthcare services for immigrant populations. Tell us a little bit about that, how that's gone, where that stands now.
Yeah, so Action Health NYC is a pilot that came out of a task force that the mayor had, and it was a very small pilot. It was about 1,300 individuals, but the idea was to really test what the best ways to engage people in care who don't have insurance and, see if by adding sort of like linkages between different types of institutions, so health centers and, the H&H, the public hospitals, whether adding sort of care coordination services so that people don't get lost and people don't get stuck in the process of navigating care in these institutions, whether that improved outcomes. And so the city put together a pilot project enrolled a bunch of people, and they were sort of really looking to see sort of what happened and what the experience was for those patients and whether it was instrumental in keeping them out of the emergency room and whether it was instrumental in helping them keep appointments that they needed. And I think the idea down the road was to see whether there was any opportunity to improve health outcomes through this. And it's important to keep in mind that even as this pilot was going on, there are many, many, many uninsured people that can, you know, have gotten and will continue to get care through H&H services, especially through a program called H&H Options, which provides really, really affordable.
And by H&H, we're referring to the public hospital system here in the city.
Yes, yeah. Sorry, health and hospitals, New York City health and hospitals, that's important.
Right.
So it wasn't that this program was the only thing for people who were uninsured, but it was a really, really intentional effort to figure out how to provide this care in a better way. And it turns out that the city is not going to continue to fund it. It's not going to continue this pilot. And so we advocates are really... we think it's unfortunate that it won't continue. We do hope that some of the lessons, if there are any lessons coming out of the program, the pilot, that can be leveraged and brought to bear sort of in a broader scale program, like some sort of changes for care to people who are uninsured, We hope that that will happen, and the city will really take these lessons and use the findings from the pilot to scale up in a meaningful way improvements for people who seek healthcare in these facilities.
And we got 1 minute left, so quickly let's talk about the Access Health NYC project, which has been a success, sure. And the city is actually adding more funding to. How is that what is that program, and how does it help immigrants?
Okay, so Access Health NYC is a initiative that funds community-based organizations and CBOs to do health outreach and education on rights and protections and how to use the healthcare system. And so it's funded 17 different organizations across the five boroughs to do this work. And this, we are now entering our third year of funding. And I think it has been a really big success. And many of the organizations that got these resources have done really innovative, interesting things in terms of combining outreach and education on health access, but also on access to food stamps or on other sort of wellness programs. And what we've heard from the organizations that have this funding is no one has really supported this kind of work before. No one has supported them to go out and talk about how the healthcare system works and how health insurance works or how public benefits works, sort of. And so we think it's been a huge success. Several of the organizations that got funding got additional funding, and we've learned recently a little bit about sort of how they're going to be building out their capacity and doing more for more people. So obviously, it was not a gigantic enhancement that they got, and we hope that in future years we'll be able to get new districts and new organizations with additional resources. But for now, we're very happy that the program continues, and as all of these changes that we've been talking about sort of happen or don't happen, it's going to be these organizations and ones like them that could benefit from more funds are going to be critical in terms of getting information about the changes out to hard-to-reach communities across the city.
Great. Well, we've been doing a bit of a catch-up here in this week's interview segment, taking a look at immigrant healthcare issues in Washington, D.C. and here in New York. Joining us to help sort it all out has been Claudia Calhoun, Director of Health Policy for the New York Immigration Coalition. Thanks again for joining us on Health Action, Claudia.
Thanks, Mark. Have a good day.
You too. And thanks to Reggie Johnson for engineering this segment. Bob Litter will be here in the next half of the program to continue his series on the ACT UP 30th Anniversary Conference called Hidden Voices. Stay tuned. I'm Mark Hanna.
In June, WBAI's Out FM program co-sponsored a conference with ACT UP New York titled 30 Years of ACT UP New York, Hidden Histories and Voices, Lessons Learned. The following is a panel on campaigns by and for current and former drug users and harm reduction programs from the 1980s to the current day. Former ACT UP member Amanda Lugg introduces the panelists.
The first up, although he's staying sitting down, is Tim Santamore. A little bit about Tim. With a background in anti-capitalist, anti-racist, anti-Klan, anti-war, and pro-choice activism, Tim joined ACT UP Western New York in 1991. Before moving to New York City and joining ACT UP New York in 94, he helped establish Prevention Point Buffalo, an underground illegal clean needle distribution program, and the Columbus Hospital Needle Exchange Program, which is a legal one. Over the years, he has advocated on a national level, for injection drug user, queer drug user inclusion, visibility, and influence on AIDS prevention programs and within HIV/AIDS, harm reduction, and other political movements. Tim has worked or volunteered with the Lower East Side Needle Exchange, the North American Users Union, and the fabulous Church for Ladies for Choice, yes. Reclaim the Streets, Dance Safe, and Moving Equipment Queer Harm Reduction Collective, of which he remains a member. Tim.
I hate presenting, and I hate pretending I'm some sort of expert on things, so I like remaining seated. I'd much rather have a drink with you at the bar and tell stories, as we were encouraged to do. First off, I'd like to identify myself, and there's been a little bit of talk about here about stigma. And one of the biggest things facing drug users right now in accessing healthcare and HIV prevention services is stigma around drug use, stigma around injection drug use in particular. And it's a major problem. It needs to be addressed. And so I identify as a queer man who used to inject methamphetamine. I don't at the moment, but I do not consider myself in recovery. I'm also an ex-raver, and so I used to do a lot of MDMA, acid, ketamine, GHB, and other substances. So that said, I would like to dedicate what I'm going to talk about to several drug users who've gone before me and whose work I really admired, and I miss them. The first would be Rod Sorge, who Donald Grove once told me, Rod taught us, Rod taught us anything, it was how to accessorize. Brian Weil, who was an activist in the city. Marty Prairie, a two-spirit from Asheville, North Carolina. Sylvia Rivera. Yeah. Sheila O'Shea, who was a woman of color from the West Coast, also known as Dana Beard. Who wrote a manifesto some years ago called The Drug User Union of One, which spoke specifically about the stigma of doing this work and not being able to find allies in your communities because of that stigma. Paul Wirth, a queer national West Coaster anarchist who worked with Need in Berkeley. Keith Kyler. John Paul Hammond, another injection drug user, founder of North American Users Union, and just like a massive presence and a massive loss. Don McVinney, worked with Harm Reduction Coalition. Paul Yabor, probably the most recent one that the harm reduction movement, the drug user movement, lost just recently to an overdose in Philadelphia. Janine Guerrero, who once held up a newspaper when I arrived in San Francisco. There was something going on there, and the new headline said, Gay Meth Crisis, and she held it up when I arrived that day, and she said, they knew you were coming. Amy, also known as Frank Goldberg, a person of trans experience. Angela Daigle, an injection drug user and sex work advocate. John Becker. John was probably more famously known as Anonymous. John was a drug user activist from Buffalo. He moved to New York. And about 12 or 13 years ago, a great advocate and harm reduction activist by the name of Kryn Carey fought a case in New York State court. And she had to win first the right for John to proceed as the plaintiff as Anonymous. And the reason for that was that if John had been identified as a drug user, he may have lost all the services that he was currently receiving at the time. So John proceeded, and Kryn proceeded with this case. And while it was going on, John overdosed. And it was a very difficult thing for Kryn to continue that case, knowing that she couldn't mention his name, that his name was Anonymous. And Pete Morse, a dear friend of mine, somebody who I spent many nights and well into the afternoon at Twilo. And the last four members were members of Moving Equipment Queer Harm Reduction Collective, which still kind of sort of exists. We were a collection majority drug user. We came out of ACT UP in a lot of ways. It included other folks such as Naomi Brain, Nora Gibbons, Kryn Carey, Donald Grove, Liz Paradise Kelly, Sharon Stancliffe, thank you. And we were an above-ground, unapologetic syringe distribution and later naloxone distribution program that operated both in Coney Island and in Brooklyn, in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, along the waterfront in the warehouses that used to be occupied by drug users and sex workers. So the other two people I'd like, and I'm probably going to take up my 7.5 minutes talking about people. Dave Purchase, also known as, he's kind of like the grandfather of Needle Exchange. He started the North American Syringe Exchange network and would host the North American Swing Exchange conventions. We were conventions. We were not conferences. And Dave used to open up Needle Exchange conventions by basically saying that we would never forget who was the first community to bear the brunt of this damned virus. We're not asking for a bigger piece of the pie. We're asking for a bigger pie. And that let everyone in the room know that this was not going to be a competition between gay men, people of color, and injection drug users for resources. It's not always the case in every room you walk into. The other person I need to recognize is Kathy Oliver. She is a dyke in Portland, Oregon. She is the founder of the first legal syringe exchange program in 1987. Just some of the things that ACT UP's involvement in needle exchange has kind of a difficult past. Needle exchange was not always accepted on the floor of ACT UP. From my understanding here in New York, it was also not always accepted on the floor in Buffalo. And a lot of that did have to do with some serious concerns from communities of color who were dealing with not just drug use per se as an activity, but the overall oppression within communities and government neglect on a whole lot of issues, and in a lot of cases, government exacerbation of problems. So that was understandable. It wasn't until we fought hard to make it clear that needle exchange programs weren't trying to threaten anybody's recovery. There were a lot of folks out there that for whom there were not and still are not appropriate methods of treatment, appropriate programs to go in. But there's also a number of us out here who don't look at our drug use as something bad. I celebrate my drug use, even though it's been problematic. I had some great times. And I probably might again. I don't know. But recognizing ACT UP New York's and ACT UP's around the country's involvement in needle exchanges, I have to recognize the seven folks in the city that were arrested and fought a case and won kind of the necessity lesser harm defense in New York, which was the basis for the founding of Lower East Side Needle Exchange Program, St. Anne's Corner, New York Harm Reduction Educators, Housing Works, Bronx, Harlem, and upon whose shoulders and upon whose work a lot of the programs around the state depended upon. I'll mention our saving saint, Alma Candelas, who I can't not mention. Alma worked for the New York State AIDS Institute and probably responsible for the fact that many, many people did not seroconvert. She took what we did as activists and would kind of say, and she'll kill me if it's probably, but she'd kind of say, they're at the gate. What can we give them to get them away from the gate? And then she'd turn to us and she'd say, okay, we're going to do this, this, and this. And we'd turn back and we'd say, we're at the gate again. And she could turn back and turn that into policy decisions that benefited folks. So I entered Needle Exchange in 1991. I started advocating on a national level in 1993 for the inclusion of drug users in the movement. Needle exchanges were kind of developing concurrently with ACT UP activism, and in many places, including Boston, Philadelphia, Buffalo, San Francisco, Asheville, Atlanta, Chicago, Nashville, Austin, Anchorage, St. Louis. These needle exchanges basically were started by ACT UPs, but they didn't remain ACT UP. ACT UP was not going to be a service organization. We kind of understood that when we were founding these. So we didn't require that of ACT UP. We kind of stepped off on our own and let needle exchange happen. But one of the things that ACT UP, the attitude of ACT UP brought to it was not only the ability to identify as drug users, but also the ability to challenge the at that time, one-for-one model of syringe exchange. You got a clean needle for each one you bought in. That wasn't working for drug users. Drug users were committing acts of civil disobedience every time they accessed a harm reduction needle exchange program, every time they gave somebody in their injection circle a sterile syringe. That was an act of civil disobedience. Folks went to jail for doing this. Folks like Diane McKeag in New Jersey and John Parker from AIDS Brigade ended up with felony convictions on their records for handing folks a sterile syringe. So we challenged One for One on a national level. We won that in a lot of states and a lot of places. However, programs still have to abide by it. And there's kind of an understanding that where they're abiding by that, it's a political decision that they have to make to maintain their funding. They're not doing it because they want to. One of the successes, I was asked to talk about successes, is that between 1993 and the end of the 90s, seroprevalence in New York City went from 50%, over 50% among injection drug users, to around 13%, and it's lower at this point. That was a major victory, and especially considering the fact that populations have increased. So. The other thing I would like to just talk about quickly is the notion of long-term civil disobedience. There are still needle exchange programs operating in the country that are under threat of arrest. The recent victory that we had in Massachusetts permitted two long-running, 25-year running programs in Lynn, Massachusetts, and Northampton, Massachusetts, to operate on a legal basis. So that activity continues. I'd also like to mention the intersectionality of the movement. We already heard folks identify as drug users up here. But drug use issues are women's issues. They're reproductive right issues, parenting rights, the people of color. We work in the anti-prison industrial complex movement, trans communities, queer communities, and sex work communities. And lastly, I'd like to mention the current or future state of where the harm reduction movement and drug user movements are. You might have been seeing some things pop up in the paper lately around drug overdoses. And actually, the New York Times just reported a couple weeks ago that drug overdose deaths have exceeded the peak of HIV deaths, HIV/AIDS deaths, gun violence, and car accident violence. We expect that 62,000 people this year will lose their lives to an opioid overdose. So what are we doing? Folks are out there testing for fentanyl, testing strips for fentanyl. We're doing drug testing. We're advocating for overdose reversal programs, naloxone. Everyone should be trained in naloxone. You never know when you're going to stumble upon somebody who's overdosed. Safe consumption spaces so that people can use and clean safe environments in medical settings, as well as, I guess that's it. I did mine out of order, so I didn't know. So that's kind of where we're at, and I'll hand it over to, back to Amanda.
Thanks for tolerating the timekeeping, too. I know it's disruptive. My name is Amaya Gelman. I'm going to introduce myself later. Next, we're going to hear from Annette Godino. Annette was an active organizer in San Francisco with ACT UP, Queer Nation, the Women's Action Coalition, and the Dyke March in the 90s and early 2000s. In 2012, after participating in Healthcare for the 99%, a working group of Occupy Wall Street, she joined ACT UP New York. She's worked in coalition on the Ebola pandemic, Hep C, harm reduction, and bringing single-payer healthcare to New York State. She also currently serves as HIV-HCV project co-director for TAG and organizes with Rise and Resist, which is a response to Trump's election. Thanks, Annette.
Yeah. Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for having me here. And thank you, Tim, for that just amazing talk and giving us so much history and context about the challenges, especially of how ACT UP is engaged with people who use drugs, with harm reduction for people who use drugs, and responses to the epidemic. You've kind of gone over this, but I think it bears repeating. In terms of harm reduction in HIV, the successful reduction of HIV transmission among people who inject drugs is one of the overlooked stories of the epidemic, and one of the greatest success stories of the epidemic, especially when you can put it in the context of what people you know, the general public think about drug users, that they don't care about their health, right? That they don't, that they're throwing, that they don't care about their lives. And clearly the opposite is true, right? People who use drugs and people who inject drugs mobilized and educated themselves and, you know, with support in order to create this incredible public health success story. Clearly, someone who doesn't care about their life wouldn't have done that. People who don't care about their lives don't do that, right? So I think it's important to keep telling that story because of, as we're seeing now, you know, with this current epidemic that we're facing of opioid use, which is driven in large part by pharmaceutical companies who, you know, have been our longtime nemesis. The myths are out there, right? The beliefs and the stigma and discrimination against people who use drugs hasn't gone away. Certainly hasn't. It hasn't really gotten any better in the last 20 or 30 years. But we have this incredible history lesson to show what happens when you respect the agency and the dignity of people who use drugs. So I always think of harm reduction as an ethical lens for addressing public health, criminal justice, and social exclusion, and economic inequality. It's a way of looking at the world. It's specifically meeting people exactly where they're at, honoring their choices, and honoring the fact that they have agency and can make choices. And that the core of harm reduction is respect for human dignity and that agency. And the reason I'm kind of hammering on about this is because I kind of feel like it's very easy to forget that. And that in my most recent experience with ACT UP, you know, having to reteach those lessons or have people remember those lessons. So I think it's another thing that happens over the long course of struggling against the injustices around the HIV epidemic is that we've been through so much, but sometimes we've forgotten things that we used to know, right? And things bear repeating and bear reminding. So I want to talk a little bit about hepatitis C, because that really relates to the work that I did with ACT UP, and I think it's very, very relevant to what's happening right now. But I also first want to address the question, why would we talk about hepatitis C at an ACT UP conference? Well, hepatitis C, just like HIV, it sits at the intersection of public health, illicit drug control policy, and corporate drug pricing, just like HIV, and Tim pointed that out really well. You know, just in terms of numbers, 2.3 million people are co-infected with hepatitis C and HIV worldwide, of which 1.3 million are people who inject drugs. Now, these are antibody results, so this is not a true picture of people who are actually chronically infected, but it shows the breadth of co-infection worldwide. And in the United States, according to CDC, 25% of people who are HIV positive are co-infected with hep C. So if CDC is saying 25%, you know it's more. right, you know it's more, and because the surveillance of, you know, of viral hepatitis in the United States is crap, it's pacata. You know, and we also, it's a familiar story to us in terms of some of the bad actors, right? The bad actors are very familiar. You have pharma, you have in particular Gilead, is a particularly bad actor in this case. I'm not going to rehash the whole story of the $1,000 a pill drug, but I will say that one of the things that ACT UP New York did engage in recently, and you know, I need to call out some of my some of the ACT UP people who really spearheaded the work that ACT UP is doing around Hep C, which is Luis Santiago and Ronnie Marks and other folks. You know, Gilead has refused to include, to even negotiate with New York State ADAP and about 14 other states who are members of the ADAP Crisis Task Force to even have their drugs on the ADAP formularies for co-infected people. So here you have a population co-infected. We know that people with HIV, also liver disease progresses more quickly if you have hep C. We have the numbers in terms of co-infection, and there's literally no support in the United States. There's no Ryan White for hep C. There's no ADAP for hep C, for mono-infected people, et cetera, et cetera. And Gilead won't even, you know, play ball. So again, familiar bad actors. And ACT UP New York was very successful in lobbying and getting pushing ADAP New York to New York State to include other non-Gilead drugs in the formulary so at least people can get treated. And now that there's some new pan-genotypic treatments coming out, we're going to continue that fight. So just to really quickly, contrasting HIV and hep C, you know, HCV, there's a cure. But we have no vaccine, no global fund, no PEPFAR, no Ryan White, no ADAP for mono-infected, right? There's little conversation about elimination. HIV, no cure, no vaccine, and 50% of the people in low and middle-income countries who need treatment don't have access. But we do have this infrastructure, this global infrastructure for funding. So what I like to say about hep C, it's where HIV was 30 years ago. ACT UP hopefully will continue to engage in that movement to push that forward. In recent years, we've done a lot of good work. You know, one of the things that we did in 2014 is it just turned out, just so happened that the AASLD, which is the National Organization of Hepatologists, had their annual convention in New York City, and it was right after they had put out these very restrictive treatment guidelines, you know, based on cost, not based on science, that only people who are the sickest and had cirrhosis and high, you know, advanced liver disease should be treated. Again, we've seen this movie before. ACT UP knows what to do, and we showed up, and we were lobbying and flyering and trying to educate the doctors and others who were going in and out of the conference, and who else was there but Vocal New York. And we said, hey, we should be working on this together. So we started working on this together. And then we reached out to TAG. And then Luis invited Jules Levin to come and do a teaching at ACT UP. And long story short, sooner or later, you know, before we knew it, we had the New York State Hep C Coalition formed. Right, and as a result of that work, you know, last November, we had the first sort of statewide elimination conference in New York State. We brought together all sorts of stakeholders. That led to a kind of ETE sort of process for Hep C in New York State, where we developed working groups and we got recommendations, and we tried to create a blueprint, which we finalized and then presented at a real, you know, full bore elimination summit, which happened in February, and that work is ongoing. Vocal is leading listening sessions around the state. New York State is actively engaged in trying to meet targets for elimination that have been set by WHO and is really becoming a leader in this movement, and TAG is very engaged in this work, obviously, and we're hoping that we're going to see a lot more movement in the years to come, and I know that ACT UP will be a part of that because ACT UP laid the foundation for it and was there at the very beginning of doing this work, so shout out to that. Lastly, I want to talk a little bit about more recently, what the loss of memory means for ACT UP in terms of harm reduction and the principles of harm reduction and how it plays out in other work that ACT UP is doing. And I'm talking specifically about PrEP. So, you know, in 2014, PrEP rolled out, and, you know, the community response was really shocking to me. First of all, because I thought we were a movement around sexual liberation and not about shaming people for their sexuality. So that was a little bit of a disconnect, but also I, to put it mildly, but PrEP is harm reduction. PrEP is meeting people where they're at, being honest about behaviors that people are actually doing, and intervening in ways that that give people agency, respect their agency and their dignity. So the fact that we kind of maybe forgot some of the lessons of harm reduction, the lessons that empowered drug users taught people in ACT UP, that we learned from each other, the work that we did together, you know, it comes around, right? When you forget those lessons, when you forget those principles, you know, it's going to hit the fan. It's going to keep coming. And we wasted a lot of time, I think, because we forgot some of the stuff that we used to know, right? So that's just something that I really wanted to make that connection very strongly that, we've seen this movie before. You know, the Ebola panic, we've seen that movie before. You know, PrEP, we've seen this movie before. And let's, you know, keep having kind of this kind of dialogue and this history alive, because, you know, it really does hurt us when we forget our own history. And, you know, PrEP is a perfect example of that. So finally, I just want to wrap up and say, because we have cure with Hep C, what we're doing or not doing to eliminate hepatitis C has lessons from the implementation of the eventual HIV cure, right? So everything that's happening right now are not happening right now, in terms of funders not stepping up, in terms of, you know, the same bad actors doing the things that they do, in terms of us not really being able to transform the relationship that our society has with the people who develop the drugs that people depend on. You know, there's lessons here, right? And we have to be closely watching. If we care about the end of AIDS, we have to really care about the end of hepatitis C, and we have to be watching both very, very closely. So thanks.
And you've been listening to a presentation by Annette Galdino of the Treatment Action Group and former member of ACT UP New York on drug user and harm reduction issues at the recent conference by ACT UP New York and WBAI's Out FM called 30 Years of ACT UP, Hidden Histories and Lessons Learned. And that wraps it up for this edition of Health Action. I'm Bob Lederer, and thanks to John Riley for engineering.
ever cut your grass and found a car, you might be a redneck.
Did you know that WBAI has a car donation program? Another way to support this station is by donating a vehicle, a car, a truck, RV, or even a boat. To donate a vehicle in support of WBAI, call us at 1-866-WBAI-CAR. That's 1-866-922-4227. WBAI's partners will take all of your information and take care of the details. You can also visit WBAI.org and click on the Ways to Donate banner for more information. Again, that number is 1-866-WBAI-CAR. And then you can leave the lawn ornaments to Foxworthy and friends.
Instead of cuss your poor tongue, just be not out of the words, I love you. Ooh, what little moonlight can do? Wait a while till little moonbeam comes peeping through. You'll get bold, you can't resist him, and all you'll say when you have kissed him is, ooh, what a little moonlight can do.
Good morning, this is Lister sitting in for Jim Froyne. Jim Froyne is away on assignment, and he'll be back same place, same time, right here at WBAI 99.5 FM New York, with much more science fiction than you can ever imagine.
Thank you.
99 Sink, A List Alive, sitting in for Jim Fry until 5 o'clock.
Welding, now where the young girl want. Welding, yeah. Welding, now where the young girl want. Welding. And all around Jamaica, when you can hear them talking about them soda winners, I would say. I might say, welding, now where the young. I can make them young girl move like a roach, yeah, and give them soldering. Soldering where the whole lady want, soldering, yeah. Soldering where the whole woman want, soldering. I'm anti-welding where the damsel want, welding. Blacker the girl, the sweeter her. Welding, now where the young girl want. Welding. I hear the monkey clown, the more we expose. You can't take it, you gotta stay under it. It is no bed of rose. Welding, now where the roots man want. Welding.